Today, the bull in the china shop. Hello, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, welcome to his post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the CEC. And Robbie, I want to talk to you about China, because if you hear the mainstream media, they're all saying China is terrible, the US is great, you know, don't look over in China, look at all the horrible things they're doing there. There's another story to be told, I think, and I want to try and explore that a little bit with you today.
No, there absolutely is. And there's a lot we could say. It would be limited by time, I'm sure. It's a huge subject, actually. I think the most important thing that we should try and achieve is some balance in the minds of Australians. Because, let me be slightly provocative, if they're worried about China, mostly it's because they've been whipped up by pretty unsavoury people, frankly, political forces, to make them worried about China. And if you look at the facts objectively, you realise, well, there's a lot of hype here, right? So what's the we need to get to the bottom of what's the real story.
And just to sort of set the context, right, you know, US is number one economy in the world, China is number two economy in the world and growing very quickly, and there's a lot of fear from the number one economy that number two economy could overtake them, right? And secondly, you've got the trade wars going on at the moment, and that's all about trying to actually crimp or change people's policies and strategies using trade as a lever. So that's the and then the third thing is you've got all of these other things like Huawei and the other things that are going on, and essentially everybody seems to be focusing on it just one way. And yet the story is way more complex, and there's actually probably good news and bad news on both sides, but there's a really need to find more balance in the conversation.
So let's deal with let's take what's probably relevant to Australians first, right? We field questions all the time, accusations, etc. And for the record, you know, I don't get any money from them from the Chinese Communist Party. The CEC takes no money from anyone that's associated with China at all. We're a political party. We take donations. It all comes from Australian citizens, right? Etc. We are not a paid shill on any of this, right? And I have to say that because we're getting into this kind of like McCarthyite territory where if you don't go along with the hysteria, right, are you now or were you ever a member of the Chinese Communist Party, right? And Peter Harcher in the Sydney Morning Herald, he represents peak insanity on this. He did a story a few months ago about Antarctica, right, where there's lots of governments in Antarctica, lots of countries doing things, all scientific research, and there's the Australian government, the British government, the American government, the Chilean government, you know, whatever. But when he referenced China, it was the Chinese Communist Party's activities in Antarctica, as if there's guys in green hats with red stars on it going around signing up penguins to party membership. No, China has a legitimate national government, right, and they should be talked about that way, but one of the propaganda signs you're seeing is you don't hear about China, you hear about the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party. No. You know, when you hear that, let me tell you, that's designed to whip you up, right? So let me just state that from the beginning. So Australia, we've just come through an election where Buggerlugs, Clive Palmer, spent $70 million or whatever on ads. Half of them were these extraordinary attacks on China. Right? Absolutely extraordinary. And we're about to be invaded. There's an airstrip in the Pilbara where China is about to launch an invasion of us. And then, lo and behold, after the election, the invasion began in Sydney Harbour. Three warships came in. And I have to say, when you think about the climate we've been in, it was a strange event, not because of anything China did. They were invited. They were expected. It was reciprocal. But for some reason, people in the government departments in Canberra did not even inform the New South Wales Premier it was going to happen. And I can only assume that sort of speaks to the kind of paranoia that's going on around this question and maybe, you know, setting up something that can build up hysteria, you know, sucking up to the United States or figures in the United States. It's important to not blanket the United States on this. Funnily enough, Donald Trump is not the main problem in the United States on China. He's actually a moderate. He wants to rebalance the trade with China, and he gets all rhetorical, etc. But people in his administration are a big problem, right? People like John Bolton, etc. So this happened, and we're being told we're being invaded here. Well, let's just get some. There's an example right there of false information. The man telling us that on his ads, the money he spent on those ads comes from China, comes from his business dealings with a Chinese state-owned company that has made him filthy rich, filthy, filthy, filthy rich, and he can splurge all that money on ads. That he has the rights to the land in the Pilbara where the airstrip is. That's his, effectively his land, Clive Palmer's land. And he could still have that opinion about China, except why didn't he say it in the ad? Why didn't the ads reveal that I have a business, I, Clive Palmer, who was telling you that this company is evil and they're setting up an invasion, I'm in a business relationship with them. No, because he's in a business dispute with them, right? And he's trying to use, he's opposing an expansion up there that he's hoping to get more money out of, you know, et cetera. And there's a court case going on, but we only get one side. And I think it was very cynical because Clive Palmer's not even the real problem. He was cleverly but cynically playing on the existing hysteria here. So some of the other facts, though. China's buying us up. China's buying Australia up. China's buying up our farmland. Well, the ABS has statistics, Martin. They're very good. Total foreign investment in Australia. And do you know, there's a list of all the top sources of foreign investment. And China is on that list for sure. It's number 9. It is 1/10 of the United States and the United Kingdom. 1/10. It is below Belgium. For crying out loud. Matthias Cormann is more of a fifth column in Australia as our finance minister because he's from a country originally that's a massive foreign investor. There's five times the foreign investment in Australia of China, right? So here's one, the second biggest economy in the world is 9th on the list, right? So that's a fact. If you're worried about foreign investment and you're not being, dare I say it, prejudiced, right? I'll use a milder term. And you're not being prejudiced, well, China is not your worry. However, 2, has China been buying up assets? Well, yeah. But if those who've been around long enough will know that in the 80s, it was Japan buying up our assets. What do they have in common? They're the ones with money now, right? Japan was massively booming in the 80s. They had money and they were splurging around. China's got money that's splurging it around. But the other thing I want people to think about is you can whip yourself up and think, oh, they're coming and buying us up. They wouldn't be buying us if we weren't selling us. And so, you know, the CEC has spent 30 years fighting privatization. If we had our way, nothing would be privatized. Well, there's no proof that it improves the functioning of those assets, etc. And in cases like electricity, we're just being gouged by these things, and even the Productivity Commission's said that. But that's the policy we've had. We're the ones selling. The onus is on us. China's just the country with the money at the moment, right? So when you look at those things in context, you think what you realize, well, there's a lot of overstatement there. Then there's the emotive stuff. Oh, it's farmland. Well, and China has been buying farmland, but that tells you more about what China's priorities are. China's got 1.4 billion people in an area of land not that much bigger than Australia, big chunk of which is desert, right? They've got a lot of things there, a lot of their own wealth, but they don't have things like oil, right? And of course, they need to make sure they've got that, you know, they want to set up structures, they have secure food supplies, etc. And they just prioritize those types of things. Again, we're the ones selling, and I think that's more significant than the fact that China is buying. Their purchases are sensible, is the point, right? So, I don't think we should sell Australian farmland, but if we don't, that should apply to everybody. Right, that's my view. You can't discriminate and say one country, right, deserves to be locked out here. And then, so those are the things that people think are sort of negatives about China. Oh, that, you know, that's what internet, Facebook memes are about, etc. These are the sort of things China's doing. Well, there's a bit of context for you. But what's the actual positive here? So let me put it this way. The CEC spent 30 years fighting against the policies that have made Australia so dependent on foreign capital and foreign imports. We fought all that. We never bought into this free trade idea, etc. Right, the slashing tariffs to nothing, etc. We've lost. We've destroyed our own manufacturing by doing all that. Right. So the way it's evolved, though, we have ended up becoming incredibly dependent on one country. Right, and that's not good. I don't think that's good. However, when the 2008 crash happened, we were incredibly lucky that the one country we were dependent on was China, because of how China responded to that crisis completely differently to everybody else. Now, you know, everybody in the world talks about China's debt problem, and on paper, it is a debt problem. There's a massive amount of debt there. There are certainly issues. You can't deny that. But there's the devil's in the detail. And when the economists are talking about this, what they don't distinguish is, yes, the amount of credit created in China post the GFC, which was massive, you know, in the order of $20 trillion, right? That one country created, which is kind of matched by the amount of quantitative easing created by the big central banks, Fed, you know, Bank of England, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, similar amount of money. But the difference is what they did with it, right? All that quantitative easing by Western central banks in Japan went into speculation effectively. They just let banks gamble with it. The money China created went into the biggest investment in the history of the world in real things, right? So it's still debt, it's still there, but you have to distinguish between what it was, you know, the fact that it was used for something completely different than the speculation by the West. That's a factor that has to be taken into account when you're wondering what's going to happen there. And that investment included things. Look at China's expansion of high-speed railway. Right, so you can, in this clip, you'll see it goes from what it was like at the time of the Beijing Olympics in 2008, which was a few months before the global financial crisis. One little route, right, in Shanghai there. And what it is now, 12,000 kilometres of high-speed railway in the last decade.
We'll have to zoom in because the extent of the network was one 19-mile-long maglev train from Shanghai Airport to the outskirts of Shanghai and a traditional high-speed rail line from Beijing to the coastal city of Tianjin. Today, 10 years later, that network has expanded into this. China has 8 times as much high-speed track as France, 10 times as much as Japan, 20 times as much as the UK, and 500 times as much as the US. In fact, China has as much high-speed rail track as the rest of the world combined. It is staggering the amount of progress they have made in such a short amount of time.
That's what China did following the global financial crisis. What did we do? Wait, look at the state of our economy, right? What did the United Kingdom do? You know, go look at the, while wages in the United Kingdom in 10 years haven't risen, I think the amount of money that their billionaires have has increased by $250 billion or something in a decade, right? That's how they've responded to the crisis. And they wonder why the population voted for Brexit. What's the United States got to say about for itself post the financial crisis? What's it done? What China's done is very real and very concrete. And when you see that spread of railway, ask yourself this, how much Australian iron ore is in that? Right? A lot. That's our economy there. What's kept our economy stumbling along is that, thanks to China doing that, right? And Australian coal and lots of other things. And it's worked for them, right? And we should be doing, you know, we think we should be doing the same things here. It would be, you could structure our economy a bit better. We should still have this, you know, we shouldn't be so dependent on China, but we should still be doing the amount of business we're doing with China because that's good for us, right? Dr. Wilson Tsai has done the study to show just how much of our gross domestic product in Australia depends on this trade with China, right? So this is a positive relationship we have with China, yet we're demonising it. And those are the sort of things that people need to take stock of. it's not as bad as you think. There's a lot of positives there that aren't, that don't come out in the way the media reacts.
So there's a lot of talk about the Belt and Road, right? Yep. Which is essentially China's international influencing, you know, and that's money and that's effectively relationships that they're building. And of course, that's been demonized quite significantly. What's your perspective on that?
Well, let's deal with the negative and then the positive. So at worst, if everything they say about the Belt and Road is true, at worst, China is acting no differently than the IMF and World Bank have acted for six decades, getting countries into debt and then going in there and telling them how to run their economies. And the IMF has a whole history, forcing them to privatize things that then London and New York corporations could go and buy up. Right, that's the history of the IMF. Hmm. That's called debt trap. That's debt trap diplomacy for you.
Yep.
Right, it's those Americans and Brits who are now turning around accusing China of that they've done with impunity for six decades. Right, so that's at worst. I haven't agreed accepted the premise yet, but that's at worst.
Yep.
Also at worst, just say people say, oh yeah, but China goes in there and they take their own work in there and they're doing it for their benefit. Well, that's what the Marshall Plan was in Europe after World War II, right? America did a massive investment in Europe after World War II, but American corporations massively benefited from it, right? In fact, they had to do the business with American corporations to make this work. It benefited Europe, but that, you know, it definitely benefited the United States. So that's no different. And that's the worst you can say about it, Martin, right? Whereas, what's the real story? Well, one of the reasons the CEC has the perspective we do is because we are part of a movement that in part claim credit for this. And that is so the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, right? It had been 2 years since the 1987 stock market crash. You'd had the 87 stock market crash was you could think of it as the first rumblings of the problems that was starting to become evident from the wave of deregulation financial deregulation that it had in the 1970s, started in the 70s. And as you know, that financial deregulation went hand in hand with deindustrialization, right? People talk about Michael Milken, the junk bond king, and all that kind of frenzy of financial activity in the 80s. Those guys, go rewatch Pretty Woman, right? Those guys were parasites going in and taking over industrial organizations and stripping them apart, right? Destroying the industrial base of the United Kingdom, the United States, etc., Australia as well. This had consequences, right? So anyway, you had the first signs of that, but then also, thank goodness, you know, the Soviet communism came to an end, right? Which was like the end of it was a positive thing. What happened to the poor Russians after that wasn't, but you know, they were well and truly looted, But you know, there was a possibility that you could get out of this Cold War dynamic, right? So our movement, we're associated with the movement in America led by Lyndon LaRouche and his wife Helga. And in 1996, there was a conference in China that Helga represented us at, and I know Helga well, and it was on the Eurasian Land Bridge. And this was an idea that we had been promoting, which was, look, you've had the East and the West divided, and because communism doesn't work, the lack of economic development in the East was pretty severe, right? But there was degradation happening in the West, right? Countries like China, Germany, industrial powerhouses were starting to lose their way, etc. So the idea was let's benefit both the East and the West by the West reaching out and helping invest in the East, in Eastern Europe, in China, etc., across Eurasia. Let's build infrastructure. Let's build railway lines that can go across the biggest continent we've had, that can connect the highly developed Western Europe through the East, etc., with the big population centers in Asia, right? And so you encourage trade, not in a sort of a free trade fanatical way where everyone decides whose industries they're going to give up, but in a way that you expedite it through the actual infrastructure that helps, right? People can sell their what they're good at. And you're raising living standards by doing it. That was our idea. And that was something we promoted. We're only taking partial credit for it, that, you know, the Chinese aren't dummies. So they had a conference in 1996 called the Eurasian Land Bridge our friend Helga spoke at it. She's become known as the Silk Road Lady, right? And this was the CEC, we ran our 1998 federal election campaign promoting this idea. Australia should participate in the Eurasian land bridge. We had we were working then with the late Lance Endersby, a brilliant engineering professor who was an emeritus professor from Monash University. He had great ideas like a Melbourne to Darwin high-speed railway line that could connect with high-speed shipping in Darwin, where we could take good quality Australian produce from the south, get it to Darwin in 24 hours, get into those high-speed ships, get it through to all the big massive Asian ports in 36, 48 hours after that, right? Enormously beneficial for Australian trade. You could develop the inland of Australia. So this was what we were promoting. And China, to its credit, said, let's do that. They came to it from their own direction, but we certainly influenced it. And that became the BRI. The BRI really took form, though, as part of this response to the global financial crisis. That's when it really took form. And you got to, there's what you've been told about it, but then think about it from China's standpoint. They have just raised 700 million people out of poverty, right? So the neoliberals in America and Britain, they do these essays periodically and say, look, capitalism's the perfect system. Look, it's raised 1 billion people out of poverty. Yeah, well, it's the Chinese Communist Party that did most of that, right? Through direct investment, right? And it certainly worked for them. But like with the best of what our country used to be, et cetera, and the Americans always thought this way, you go and read Franklin Roosevelt's writings about what he thought the world should be like after World War II, help the world develop. Because if you help the world develop, yes, it's good for the rest of the world, but it's also good for you because you've got a richer market that you can trade with better. It's better for everybody, right? And so China went around the world and said, let's help. It's worked for us. Let's help you. Is there self-interest in it? Of course there is. But at least it's attached to real things. I can show you maps of Africa from 200 years of colonialism, European colonialism, where there's railways all right, only from mines to ports. That's all the European colonial powers are interested in. China has actually said, let's develop. Let's open up the interior. Australia, Ross Cameron pointed this out on Sky News before he got sacked, because one of the few voices, mainstream political voice in Australia who was pro-Chinese, he contrasted Australia's approach to Papua New Guinea to China's, right? AusAid sends money to Papua New Guinea to encourage women to contest the elections, right? So that's fine. That's what we decide to prioritise. China says, we'll build you a highway across the Owen Stanley Ranges, where my grandfather fought in mud, right, in World War II. And we'll build you a highway, right? What's not to like if you're a Papua New Guinean, right? But the Americans cannot see that without saying, that is a threat to us. Now, why do they say that? Well, you've got to understand this is sort of an aside, but it's important to state. This all comes down to a decision made in 1992 when Dick Cheney was the Defence Secretary of the United States and his deputy was Paul Wolfowitz. And they just had the Operation Desert Storm in Iraq. And if you know the story, Bush Sr., a wiser head, had organised this incredible coalition to get Iraq out of Kuwait. And that's all they were there prepared to do, and they did it. And Wolfowitz said, no, we've got to go in there and commit and have regime change in Iraq. And the wiser heads prevailed. Well, the little cabal he was part of in that Bush administration, you know, they bided their time in a sense. But they did something then that set up all this, which is they announced a doctrine called the Wolfowitz Doctrine. And that's basically, the Wolfowitz Doctrine was America's foreign policy has to be geared towards precluding the rise of any rival military or economic power. In other words, America said, we will not tolerate a rival militarily or economically. There will be one superpower in the world and that's us, right? And even Biden at the time called it Pax Americana, the American empire. That's not who we are, right? But that has become American foreign policy doctrine ever since, that Pax Americana idea. And it would be okay if America could back it up. But they inflicted their own economic problem. China didn't undermine their economy. It was that's where Trump is wrong. Those American corporations couldn't outsource fast enough, right? Throw it, get all that cheap labor, and China was prepared to take the factories, but smartly, because they're China and not some, banana republic, said, well, you're going to share your technology with us. And no one cared while the balance was well and truly in America's favor, right? That's just China being smart. And they took full advantage of it. But China, while America deindustrialized itself, China industrialized itself. And now America cannot back it up economically. They do have a rival economic power. All America's got is their military might, which is based on, again, massive discrepancy between what China spends on its military. Those three Navy ships are probably most of their Navy, right? And America spends $700 billion to China's $100 billion, right? That's all America's got. And so those maniacs who gave us, the people like John Bolton, et cetera, in the US administration, these are the people who are responsible for the Iraq War, the disaster there, for Libya, for Syria. They are, I regard someone like John Bolton as a war criminal, right? That's how this guy is the worst of the worst. And I don't know why Trump employs him, but, it's a messy system over there. John Bolton wants to bomb Iran. John Bolton wants to bomb North Korea. Right? John Bolton wants regime change in China. Steve Bannon just said we need regime change in China. What are they? Who are these people? Right? And they're who we're going along with. That's who Australia, when we're playing these funny bugger games geopolitically about China, we're going along with those people who have a track record of the last 20 years of total disaster. They've given the world a disaster. And China's supposed to be the one that's the threat. No, they've just gone about and again, aside, when you talk about their economic success in China, it's success that's materially benefited the majority of people. You cannot say that about the growth rates that we always claim in Australia and America and all this kind of stuff. There's never been more massive inequality. Right? Now, apparently there is inequality in China, but it's the one place where the inequality is because the poor people have jumped up quite a lot, but the rich people have jumped up really, whereas in the West, it's more poor people have gone stayed stagnant or gone down, and the rich people have become richer and richer and richer. So it's real economic growth in China, and America's problems, they did it to themselves. But they're the ones that define this doctrine through which is the prism through which they see the world, and consequently, they're looking at what I think is a positive. It's one of the best things going on in the world right now. Go to the African countries that have these railways, right? That have better ports. Ask them. In fact, some of these people, they make funny comments on Twitter. If America doesn't like what China's doing to us, come and compete with them. We won't mind, right? Because it's a first for Africa. They've never seen anything like it, right? And finally, they get to experience something positive. And as for the debt trap stuff, there's lots of things to refute it. When you hear about it, just search the internet a little bit. But the main one is they talk about Sri Lanka, right? The port that China took control of. China has control of our Darwin port in a similar way. We chose to privatise it. China's not going to say no, right? Sri Lanka did the same thing, but a couple of Sri Lankan academics, including one at Monash University, have studied and said, look, Sri Lanka's debt problems are not made in China. In fact, the debt that they have to China is very low interest debt, right? And China has proved to be quite flexible. The worst of their debt is from the Asian Development Bank and international money markets, which is quite high debt. And that's what's put them in the bind. China actually gave them a way out by letting them do this. But if you don't look at the world through the prism of the United States foreign policy doctrine, that there can be only one superpower, right, then you realise this is not what it seems to be. And if we don't move away from that doctrine, countries like Australia should be saying to the United States, look, yes, you have an important role in the world to play, but, encourage the better side of Trump. Do your deals with China. Sure. The trade has gone out of balance. Rectify it. You'd have to have a trade war to do that. China came to the table quite a lot. What they wouldn't do, this is important, what they wouldn't do in these last round of trade negotiations is agree to America's demands to allow things like total, like open up to Google, for instance. Google have total free market, free open slather to China. China won't agree to that kind of thing, right? They do run their country differently, and they know that Google and those kind of that kind of infrastructure, that is, you know, the NSA is right behind that, right? China is does guard itself in those kinds of ways. And that was too much. It was the non-trade stuff that became the sticking point. The actual trade thing, China made a lot of concessions, right? And but that's because Trump's not calling the shots entirely. It's some of these other people around here that are trying to run an agenda.
And I guess that touches on one last thing I wanted to discuss. Of course, it's the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square event. And of course, that's got a lot of coverage.
Yeah.
How do we sort of think about that in a China context, bearing in mind that, that, you know, many people regard this as a very, very bad event? How do you see it?
I've always seen it as a very, very bad event. Always. But it has occurred to me in recent times that, and you see it with the anniversary, the way the media is all over it,
sure,
right? It has occurred to me in recent times, you know, as I've been older and involved in politics, because I was a kid in 1989, I've fought the Iraq War, fought the claims about weapons of mass destruction, Libya and the lies in Syria, forget it, right? That I can give you chapter and verse. I'm on the front line of the disinformation there. And it's occurred to me that most of what we think we know about Tiananmen Square effectively comes from the same sources, right? And that doesn't justify that at all. But that's not the point. But I want people to think about that, right? And if you grew up in the Cold War, I was on the end of it. But it was, the Cold War propaganda was full on, and Western people were arguably more propagandized than the Soviets, the communists. There's a joke in Russia that the difference between a state-controlled media and a free media is the people who live under a state-controlled media know they're being lied to. Right, in the West, you know, we think it's all great, and then you find out later, you know, how much is lies. No. So something it was a bad event, but okay. What's China done since, and what's the West done since? So since then, China has done those things that I've said. Mm-hmm. Right? Did China invade Iraq and help kill a million people? No, actually opposed it. Did China invade Libya? On similar false information, and turned it into a haven for ISIS and where slavery is now happening again in Libya, right? No, they actively opposed it. Likewise in Syria. China's role in Syria is they would like to help with the reconstruction of Syria, and they've got the runs on the board and can do it, right? They can come in and help reconstruct Syria. When America goes in and reconstructs one of these countries, just go look at Iraq. Right, there's a great documentary you can watch by Naomi Klein called The Shock Doctrine, and it's about this a series of countries, including Iraq in 2004. And I've spoken to a gentleman who was there representing the US Treasury at the time. He's an economist in Melbourne. I'm going to interview him for our show soon. He was there. He saw what the US. He is actually an Iraqi, but he lived in Australia, but he went over back there to help. And all they're interested in doing was dividing up the spoils. Right, so. Even the so-called reconstruction is nasty and just gouges the population. China wasn't involved in any of that. What China has done is materially raise the living standards of close to a billion people. That's what they've done since. And so a million, look, even if you don't take the million person estimate in Iraq, right, it's at least closing in on 500,000 people. That was an invasion on a lie, right? Far, far, far greater than anything China did at Tiananmen Square. The 19th of March 2018, does everyone remember how on the 15th anniversary of that invasion, the Australian government, the British government, and the American government publicly expressed regret, publicly apologised for what they did? Do we all remember that? Right? Of course not. They're not going to express regret for that, right? Yet the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, they're saying to China, why isn't China regretful of what happened in Tiananmen Square, right? Well, unfortunately, countries don't tend to do that very much. Before Kevin Rudd said sorry in 2007, it was, total official, effectively denial from the Australian government that anything bad might have gone on, right? Black armband of history, etc. It's not unusual how China's behaving. I'm not saying I approve or disapprove, but the main thing is get some context here, right? Because the people that want to make an issue out of this definitely have an agenda, and it's that American Pax Americana idea that is putting the world in real danger. And let me just say quickly, I had the pleasure of working with the late Malcolm Fraser for the last few years before he passed away. He passed away a few weeks before he was going to address our 2015 conference, which was ironically called the World Land Bridge. Peace on Earth, Goodwill towards All Men. Malcolm Fraser was going to come and address that. He, as someone who was a Cold War warrior, as hard as can be, as the Prime Minister of Australia, Defence Minister in the Vietnam War, sent young men to their deaths in Vietnam, etc. None of which he resolved from, he saw that was for the times. But when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, he was part of a generation who said, well, we've won. We don't need NATO. We don't need to treat them as potential enemies. Let's reach out the hands of friendship. Let's get along, right? And instead, people were sidelined and a hardcore military agenda came in the West. And that we see that as having set most of this up. And what the public get at the moment is a lot of disinformation from that comes out of those types of networks. Every bad thing in China gets absolutely amplified all over the world. The evidence is thin. Even the million people in concentration camps Xinjiang with the Uyghurs, right, in China. They claim a million people. Well, it was an American person on a UN subcommittee that claimed that, and that became global news. And if you believe that, then you'll believe the news. All the news last week reported that Kim Jong-un executed the guy who negotiated with Trump on his behalf. Well, that guy just turned up at a banquet with Kim Jong-un yesterday because our Western media, they grab this stuff and they just repeat the lies. They're either in on it or they don't question it, right? Because to them, their job is to make those rivals or whatever look bad, right? And so you just got to put those sort of things in context. And even if it was as bad as they claim, if there's a million Uyghurs in concentration camps in Western China, if that's true, well, what would happen if any of them got on boats and came to Australia? What would we do to them? We'd put them in a concentration camp on Manus Island or the other place. And, so don't kid yourself, right? I reckon as an Australian, I want Australia to have a peaceful role in the world, right? And have promote good relationships with countries. You want to take on what is bad, but at the end of the day, my responsibility as an Australian is to my own country and making sure my own country is following the rule of law. My own country is not around doing raids on journalists, right? My own country is not locking up people indefinitely to crush their spirits, right? And so when I'm so busy fighting that, I'm not going to be let people who are responsible for that try and tell me that I need to be afraid of the country that's raising living standards, doing the best, is a best business partner, right? And is actually showing the world that you can have an economic system that works for people.
Robbie, thank you very much for your time. And I think it's what I want to stress as a philosopher, as by training, there is a worldview within which we operate. The trouble is that worldview is often not understood, nor it's just assumed,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it's really important to understand that there are other worldviews that are actually equally appropriate, and in some cases more appropriate, but more important, you've got to question the context for what you see.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you take it hook, line, and sinker, and you can end up with actually not really understanding what's going on. So thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Martin. Thanks for the opportunity.
Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. See you next time.